So, if you found the stuff about epis, monos, split, strong, whatever, flavor, quite confusing, that's exactly the idea. Because even though things sound familiar, that does not mean at all that they are familiar. So be very careful in making statements. Make sure that they reflect what you want to say. The next thing I want to talk about is, which perhaps makes the whole category worthwhile, and this is what should be the morphisms between categories. Now, I put them in quotes because they are normally not called morphisms, they're called functors. So definition. Given C and D categories, a functor F from C to D consists of a map, again called F, from the objects of C to the objects of D. In other words, to every object in C, one assigns an object F of X in D. B, for every ordered pair, or every pair, X, Y, of the objects of C, a map of sets, don't have to write of sets because it's automatic, which you all call F, namely from the morphisms from X to Y in C to the morphisms in D from F of X to F of Y. So, and oh, and these data are subject to the following condition, so such that for each pair F, X to Y, G from Y to Z of composable morphisms in C, the following diagram commutes. I'll probably will abbreviate this in the future to FDC, the following diagram commutes, because it will come up again and again and again. So, well, clearly, here we have F, here we have G, and so if we apply our functor F to it, when we get, on the one hand, we get FX, FF, FY, FG, FZ, and of course we could as well apply F to the composition. And so the key word here is that this little deformed triangle commutes. In other words, the functor F respects composition. So, well, what else could it mean to have a functor? This is what it is. And to see some examples, We'll have lots of examples later because they come up all the time. But here are sort of the interesting class of so-called forgetful functors. Which is sort of the thing where you forget a piece of the structure. For example, you could take the category of commutative rings. You could forget that the ring is commutative. Just take the underlying ring. You could forget the multiplication. Go to the category of abelian groups. You could forget the addition. Could go to the category of monoids. So let's say we have R plus times. Well, same thing, right? R plus times. Here you would remember only the addition. Here you would remember the multiplication. And you could as well forget the structure entirely and simply look at the underlying set. And clearly, for example, whether you forget addition first and multiplication next or the other way around doesn't matter. Now, this is sort of silly, huh? Here's another one. From groups to abelian groups. Take a group G and assign to it its abelianization. It's a functor because every group homomorphism from G to H induces the homomorphism between the abelianizations, and it clearly respects composition. We could as well, for example, if you have let's do this word. Simplicial sets, groups, rings, what have you. So the basic staple of algebraic topology is really talking about functors. Well, what is the base category? Well, what's usually called delta. Delta is the category, so the simplicial category well, its objects are the finite linearly ordered sets. In other words, you have a finite set which is ordered, and for any two elements you can decide which one is larger and which one is smaller. And so what are the morphisms? So the non-decreasing maps. So, in other words, if you have A less than B, then for a map, F of A has to be, sorry, if A is smaller or equal to B, F of A has to be smaller or equal to F of B. Can collapse elements, but it has to do so in order. And so what is then a simplicial set? So if C is a category, then a simplicial object over C is by definition is nothing but the functor F from the opposite category of delta to C. and the functor G, let's say, from delta to C is a so-called co-simplicial object. Sounds weird, perhaps, because especially if you have ever thought about simplicial sets, it's probably not exactly in this way. So this will play a prominent role later on, so I won't even go into details right now, just so as a first throw at you to see that these things come up in come quite different guises. Now, what would you say happens, say, if you take the category of vector spaces, you take a vector space V, and you want to assign to it its dual space? Now, it's again a vector space, right? But is it a functor? Yes or no? That's a good answer. I like that. Because both opinions are present in the literature. It certainly does not match this definition, because dualization reverses the order of composition. So if you want to make it a functor in this sense, you have to declare it to be a functor on the opposite category. No. Because a cofunctor sort of would be just reversing the arrows. All the arrows. No. So what one does, you see, this is artificial in the sense that I could think of the duality as well as a functor from the vector spaces into its dual. Right? So both this and this were functors, but they would have different domain and target, which is also not too comforting. So sometimes one says, okay, fine. So we'll give it a different name, or we'll call it a contravariant functor. So, in the sources where these things are called contravariant functors, then what I call a functor would be called a covariant functor. However, I believe this is just too much baggage, and for me a functor is always covariant. It's always this definition. But you should be aware that sometimes it's not the best choice, because, for example, for the duality, well, which one do you want? Do you want to think of it this way, or you want to think of it this way? Of course, it makes no difference. But why give yourself a choice if there isn't really one? Right? So sometimes it's called... So a contravariant functor is the object, is the same definition, except that in this diagram, the arrows get reversed on the right side. All right. So what are typical functors? Well, you see, they come in co- and contravariant versions. So let me do the covariant versions first. Let's say you have a category and you have an object X. Well, then this object defines, it's sometimes called H upper X, which is hom C from X. And that's a functor from C into the category of set. So what does it do? Well, to each object Y, it assigns the set hom C X Y. And remember, this is a set by definition of the category, even though the category doesn't have to be small. And so if you have a morphism from Y to Z, then, of course, what you do is it's just composition with F. Yeah, and it's contravariant in X. See? It's a map from X to something. So the contravariant argument should be on top. Yes, and that is the other one. So H lower X is going to be the functor where you look at all morphisms into X. But this is contravariant. So it's usually thought of as a functor from the opposite category of C into sets. And, of course, the definition is clear, right? Now, you can combine the two. So here, this is so crucial that I'll... There is a lot of terminology invented to describe this kind of functors. So one says, so first of all, so here's a bunch of definitions. C is any category. A pre-sheaf on C is a contravariant functor from C to sets, i.e., functor from the opposite category to sets. Now, that's where we run into trouble with the set theory, not the number theory, the set theory. Because if C is not small, then you would like to think of all the functors as being the objects of a new category, but it will blow up your universe. So if you were to look at the pre-sheaves on the category of sets, it's like taking the power sets of sets. So that's where one sometimes only defines pre-sheaves on small categories to be on the safe side. But the notion is there in general. And now the question, I just alluded to it, and I said, well, I want to make this into a category. So what should be morphisms of functors? But let me finish this first. So a pre-sheaf is any such contravariant functor. One says, so F is representable if there exists an X in C such that HX, which one? HX, well, equals F. That's not exactly what we want. We want it isomorphic to F, but I haven't defined that yet. I realize that. But just to tell you, to tie it up to this notion before I define it. So, and then one doesn't usually say co-representable because it's clear. If you have a contravariant functor, well, it can only be of this type if it is representable. If it is a covariant, of this type. If it is a covariant functor, it's representable. That means it's of this type. You could, some people distinguish and say this one is representable, this one is co-representable. I think this is slightly overdoing it again. Because sort of the variance will tell you if it is representable where the object has to go, into the contra or the covariant argument. So now we need to understand what are morphisms of functors. And they, in the old days, these were called natural transformations. Morphisms of functors. because you think of functors as just form being another category. And so then you have morphisms, and sometimes they're called natural transformations, but then you have very silly, then you write something like this for the morphisms between two functors, F and G, and I think this is just crazy. So I won't use this. I would use morphisms or HOM, F, G. So what is it? Well, first of all, you have to have, so let's say F and G are two functors between same pair of categories. So F and G are functors from C to D. Then a morphism from F to G, say alpha from F to G, consists of a morphism alpha x from F of x to G of x in D for each object in C. Right, so you index it by the objects in C, and the morphisms are on the images. So they are in D in particular. F of x and G of x are in the target category. So one for each object in C, such that, well, the following square commutes, namely you have for each morphism F from X to Y in C, the square, we have FX, GX, alpha X, here you have F of F to FY, here you have GY, here you have alpha Y, GF commutes. So here's an example, let's say, for typical thing. Let's say we'll look at the category of commutative rings. So let's say we take such a ring, and let's fix some integer, positive integer n. And the first functor we'll define goes into the category of groups, and it takes R to the invertible n by n matrices over R. This is a functor called the functor GLN, because if you have homomorphisms between rings, well, just apply the homomorphism to the entries of the matrix. That maps an invertible matrix to an invertible matrix and is a group homomorphism, so it is a functor. On the other hand, you can map it to groups by just assigning to R the group of units, so with multiplication. And then there is a morphism of functors, which is called the determinant. So here we have two functors, and the determinant would be then a morphism of functors. Well, it shouldn't be. Sorry, I shouldn't write it here from groups to groups. So I should really. Sorry, that was too sloppy. So we have a morphism from the functor GLN to the functor det, to the functor star, which is given by the determinant. And that's just the fact that whether you first calculate the determinant and then apply the homomorphism, or you first apply the homomorphism to the matrix and then take the determinant, that you get the same result. That's precisely the statement that this is a morphism of functors. Now, of course, what's the most important functor? Well, on any category, it's the identity. Right? So if you take any category, then there's a so-called identity functor. Well, what does it do? Nothing, right? Leaves every object alone, leaves every morphism alone. Now, if we look, for example, at the abelianization of a group, well, then we get a functor from groups to abelian groups. Now I want, but we can also map, of course, the abelian groups to groups by simply forgetting that our group was abelian to begin with. So what's a composed functor? Well, it's still the same, except that you forget that what you got was an abelian group. So then there is, of course, there's a natural transformation from the identity functor on groups to the abelianization functor, namely the projection. Right? You take any group G, then there is a natural group homomorphism onto G modulo the commutator subgroup, and that is compatible with group homomorphism. So you can think of this as taking the identity functor on groups. Don't do anything. Take a group, mapping it to the abelianization, and that is that's a morphism of functors. Here's another one. See, we said, well, we have difficulties with the dualization because that was a contravariant functor. But if I dualize twice, it becomes covariant again. Right? So for example, on the category of vector spaces, I have two functors to itself. One is the identity and one is the double dual. And then there is a natural transformation or morphism between the two, which is sometimes called the norm homomorphism. So the norm homomorphism, or also written U, goes from the identity on vector spaces to the double dual. And which map is that? Well, if you have any vector space, you have to give a map into the double dual. And how does that go? Well, you take any vector V, and so you need to come up with a linear form on the linear forms. So any linear form lambda goes to lambda evaluated on V, right? So it's just the evaluation in V, which is the image. Now, clearly, this is an isomorphism if your vector space happens to be finite dimensional. It's never an isomorphism if the vector space is not finite dimensional, because this, for example, this side will always have much larger cardinality than this. So, if we were to restrict ourselves to the category of finite dimensional vector spaces, then this would be an isomorphism on each object. And so here's a little lemma, just to show that indeed things are as they should be. You see, because we talked about morphisms of functors, because we had, so, of course, okay, first lemma. So, functors from C to D form a category. With the morphisms as just defined. However, there is a big set theoretic caveat one has to make here. Because if you want to do this and iterate it, for example, then you run out of space within your set theory. So even if you start with a small category and you look, say, at the pre-sheaves, that's a large category. So if you were to look at pre-sheaves on pre-sheaves, you are definitely out of this universe. So this is where the kind of, where one has to be careful that one doesn't get into a loop and runs afoul of logic. So what I wanted to say, so because we have now that it's a category, we can talk about isomorphisms, epimorphisms, monomorphisms. So here's the lemma I really wanted. So this was the first statement. The second statement is a morphism alpha from F to G of functors is an isomorphism if and only if alpha x from f of x to g of x is an isomorphism. Of course, in D for each x. So sort of the two notions are the same. Whether you say you have a morphism, it's an isomorphism of functors, or you say the components of the morphism of functors are isomorphisms, that's the same thing. Well, what's the inverse of alpha? Well, clearly for each x, you take the inverse of alpha x, because the inverse is uniquely determined, there is no choice involved, thus it's well defined, and so you see that alpha inverse at x is the same as alpha x inverse. So you don't have to go the extra mile. It just comes automatically with the territory. Now, one important distinction. So what we said then is, for example, that the norm morphism from the identity to the double dual is an isomorphism on the category of finite dimensional vector spaces. But the functors are not equal. Would be a stretch to claim that they are equal. Now, one could think that, okay, fine, we have now isomorphisms of functors, epimorphisms of functors, monomorphisms, because we have a category, so that's it. But isomorphism of functors are usually useless.
I was one step ahead of myself.
You see, now, because we have okay, here's lemma two. If F from C to D and G from D to E are functors, so is GF. Functors can be composed. So we have now the following situation. We could also talk about F is an isomorphism. Well, if it admits a two-sided inverse, if there exists a G from D to C such that FG equals the identity on D, and GF equals the identity on C. Sort of that comes automatically out of the concept. However, this is a bad notion. It's almost useless. What is much more important is to say F is an equivalence of categories. I
And what does that mean? Well, it still means there exists some functor going the other way, but now we do not require that the composition is equal to the identity. We only require it to be isomorphic to the identity. Looks a tiny difference, but makes all the difference in the world. For example, remember last time I talked about the category of groups with two elements. I also talked about the fact that there is essentially only one group with two elements. So how do we console these two notions? By saying we have two equivalent categories. It doesn't matter whether you look at all groups with two elements or you just look at one and think of this as a category in itself, so the classifying category of this one group. Then the inclusion, that is picking out this one specimen of the two element groups, is an equivalence of categories. It reduces this humongous thing out there, which has all the two element groups, to collapses it to a single thing. Of course, these two categories are never isomorphic because one is way, way larger than the other. But that's, of course, the essential notion one tries to capture. So two categories C and D are equivalent. Well, if, and I leave it to you to complete the sentence. So two examples, and then need to rush off. So I take the category of finite dimensional K vector spaces. Well, what's the main theorem of linear algebra? The main theorem of linear algebra is to say this is equivalent to the category, well, let's call it CK, where the objects of CK are the natural numbers. So we're starting with 0, just to make sure. And what are the morphisms? So hom CK from N to M, well, these are just the N by M, well, M by N matrices over K. So M by N. I just made it up, so make up whatever you like. Matrices over K, yes. Right? Because that's just saying the finite dimensional vector space is essentially the same thing as K to the N, where N is a dimension. Thus, I can enumerate all the vector space simply by giving their dimensions. And what are the morphisms? Well, if I choose a basis, every morphism is represented by a matrix. And so you see the inclusion, there's a natural inclusion from CK into the finite dimensional K vector spaces, which sends N to K to the N with its standard basis, or just K to the N, and sends any matrix, M, to the corresponding linear map. Well, no, I had to. Yeah. But clearly the two are not the same. But this is an equivalence. But what does it mean? How do you get back from here to here? Well, you have to identify a vector space with K to the N. In other words, you have to choose a basis. So the morphism going the other way around is a choice of a basis in a vector space. Huh? The second example is very similar in nature. Namely, if you look at the Simplicio category delta, then delta is equivalent to the category of of intervals. Well, did I say usually in the Simplicio category one usually takes finite non-empty linearly ordered sets, so I'll take 0n, n greater or equal to 0. So where you think of this as the interval of natural numbers with their natural ordering. And then, right, so 0 small or equal to 1, small or equal to n, and so a map between the two is just any order-preserving, non-decreasing, non-decreasing map between these two intervals. And that's usually how you think about it, because then a functor on this category just assigns for each such interval, in other words, for each integer n, you assign an object, and then you have to figure out what are the non-decreasing maps between two such intervals. We'll come back to this later. Now, what this also allows us to do is sort of to get rid of this nonsense of the category of all two groups, groups of two elements. Namely, we say that a category is essentially small, or sometimes it's called skeletally small, if it is equivalent to a small category. So, for example, the category of all groups of two elements is equivalent to a very small category. And that's sort of the kind of notion. Finite dimensional K vector spaces, of course, is small to begin with. If you take all K vector spaces, is it small or not small? Essentially small.
Sorry, all vector spaces?
Yeah.
No,
not small. Not small, right? Because what's a skeleton? Another, what's the skeleton of a category? And that's the last thing I'm going to say. Is any subcategory, let's say S and C, such that if X, Y, and S are isomorphic, implies X equals Y. So in other words, each isomorphism class is represented exactly once. Now, what I didn't say and realize, try to go too fast here, what is a subcategory? Well, a subcategory, there are two different ways you can think about it, and that's why I need to say a word about it. Well, if you have a category C, then C prime is a subcategory of C, written like this, means that first the objects of C prime are contained in the objects of C. And the second thing, that if you look at the morphisms in C prime from X to Y, that this is a subset of the homomorphisms in the bigger in the ambient category. So you have two inclusions here, on the object side and the morphism side. But if you have equality here, then you call it a full subcategory. In other words, you just choose, pick some objects out of it, but the morphisms don't get touched. They are the same as before. You don't throw any morphisms away. And then, so one should insert here, when I talked about the skeleton, one should insert full, any full subcategory, which has where each isomorphism class is represented exactly once. That's called the skeleton of a category. And you say a category is skeletally small if its skeleton is small. So this is the right notion of smallness for categories. Thank you very much. As I said, I need to rush to get to Scarborough.